Hello, and welcome to episode 47 of the Derailed Podcast. I'm Chris.
And I'm Fred.
We're back.
We are.
It's only been a week.
Indeed. Yes, it's good to be regular again.
Yeah. Have you been eating a lot of bran?
Yes.
It could be. Yeah, so I was saying to Fred before we started recording that we're going to try and keep things as regular as possible, whether or not we have some kind of like a big topic to talk about or not. We're going to just try and make sure that we stick to our old recording schedule and get ourselves back on track, because I think that's always been our thing.
Yeah, and it's fun.
Yeah, and if you start releasing episodes every 3 weeks, people will expect them to be good.
Yes, they should then be quality.
Yeah, exactly. So we don't want to hold ourselves to too high of a standard here. So weekly it is.
We'll go for quantity, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I wanted to shout out a couple of our sister, do you call them sister podcasts, even though they're all dudes?
Yeah, sure.
I feel like you always do. No one ever says like the brother, whatever.
No.
I don't know why that is.
Yeah, I don't know. Sister podcasts.
Anyway, I heard our name. I was catching up on some of the other train podcasts and I heard our names on Wheel Tapping and on Train Shuffling. So you remember we did that top five, those top five episodes?
Yeah, with the Discord guests.
Yes, yeah. Yes. So then Wheel Tapping did one and they said, you know, challenge extended to Train Shuffling as well. So they said they were doing it because they heard our one and they thought, yeah, that's fun. And then they said,
awesome.
Come on, Train Shuffling, you do one as well. So we accidentally started a trend.
Oh, that's cool, man.
Yeah, so I'm expecting Train Rush to produce their top five shortly.
Yes.
Keep it going. Yeah, and then I was listening to Train Shuffling. I think it was their latest episode, but they were talking about our episode on the 89 private auctions as well. Mm-hmm. So thanks for that.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, because they were chatting. Someone had messaged them and asked them for advice on sort of waterfall auctions in general. And I think they were using 89 as an example. And they said, oh, by the way, you know, we had done ours as well.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, so that was cool. Thanks, guys. It's always fun when I was like walking around my house listening to this podcast. I was like making my wife tea or something. Mm. And then I walked in to give it to her and they were like, oh, we should mention the Derailed podcast. I'm like, do you hear this? Are you hearing this? I'm famous. Do you hear that? They're talking about me, by the way.
Awesome.
I didn't plan this. I didn't just walk in. I didn't just figure out the timestamp and walk in as I was bringing you tea.
Standing outside with the tea for 5 minutes.
Yeah, like, what are you doing? Why is this cold? Yeah, exactly. So thanks, guys. Mm. I felt cool.
Yeah, that's very cool.
Yeah, and we got, you said there was a new patron you wanted to chat about quickly, hey?
Yes. I'll
give him a shout out.
We have a new patron, Stephen Suhar, signed up. Thank you very much, Stephen. We appreciate it. He sent us a mail via Patreon as well.
Oh, cool.
So he says he loved the genius or grifter from the recent What to Do When You're Ahead episode. And then he says, like, on the notion of bluffing to call a game, backgammon handles this brilliantly with the doubling cube. Basically, just raising the idea of the doubling cube, as in backgammon. I don't know if you know backgammon and how the doubling cube works.
I've played backgammon, but I don't remember how the doubling cube works.
So normally, if you just play for fun, you don't use the doubling cube.
That's probably why I haven't used it.
Okay. Yeah. So, but people play backgammon for money, and you can do it for points as well if you want. So basically how it works is there's a doubling cube. So let's say we're playing for $1, our game of backgammon, you and I, okay? And then at any point during the game, if either one of us thinks that we're ahead, we can double the stakes. So we can say, so you basically take the doubling cube and put it on the two face up, saying, okay, I'm doubling the stakes of this game, so now we're playing for $2. You can either accept that and carry on playing for $2, or you can say no and just pay me the dollar that we originally played for.
Right. Oh, that is clever.
And so one is, let's say you accept the double. Now, like the doubling cube, I think I have this right, but now I can't double again. You can double, however. At the beginning of the game, anyone can double, but then whoever accepted the last double, it's their option to double again. So you could even decide straight away that you think I'm wrong and you can just double right back. You can say, okay, let's make it for $4 instead of $2. At which point I can say, okay, no, I'll just give you the two. If I were bluffing, you would call my bluff there, right?
Right.
So the interesting thing with that is, so backgammon is a bit of a probability game as well, because there are dice rolls involved. You can set yourself up in a position where you are most likely to win backgammon, regardless of the dice rolls that come out. Obviously, there will be dice rolls where you get unlucky and your opponent will win. But it's that kind of like a probability game, which is interesting. Yeah, so he raises the idea of a doubling cube in 18xx. What do you think about that?
I mean, I just love the concept straight up. Mm. Maybe it's the like poker lover in me, but I love that idea of sort of like, I think I'm going to win this game and I'm going to basically put money on it.
Yes.
And yeah. Now I'm putting pressure on you to either accept what I'm saying, that I'm going to win this game, or you have to be confident enough that I'm either bluffing or that I'm wrong. Oh, I love that concept. Yeah. It's very cool.
Backgammon is actually an awesome game. I don't play
it. It is actually a really good game. Mm. It doesn't get enough credit, I think. I think it gets overshadowed by a lot of the other ones. The sort of chesses and whatever of the world. But I had a cousin, actually, who was quite into it. And he sort of, we spent a holiday together or whatever, you know, at Kruger Park or one of those kind of holidays. And we played quite a lot. He taught me how to play and he taught me kind of some of the strategy of it. Mm. And things like that. And he was quite into it. He had a nice set. So we played quite a lot, actually. And I got quite into it then. We never used the doubling cube because I guess we were just playing casually. I was probably like 14 as well. So okay. I didn't really have money to put on the line. But yeah, I remember that. And I remember thinking like, oh, this is a really cool game.
It is. Yeah, it's a very cool game. Yeah. Yeah, I used to play a lot of it as well, just on like the tablet. So just playing basically against PC players mostly. But yeah, it's a fun game. Should actually play
again. There's some interesting decisions in it. Yeah, it's quite cool.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, yeah.
Because you roll the dice, but then you have to decide how to use the dice. It's not just like, oh, I'm going to roll two sixes. Yay. You know, you get interesting decisions when you actually roll the dice in terms of how you'd like to use them.
Yeah, it's that input randomness versus output randomness that board gamers talk about, right?
Yes.
So backgammon is kind of like input randomness. Like you get the dice, now you still have a decision on what to do.
Yeah. So I don't know if we've spoken about it before on the podcast, but essentially we talk about it a lot in the context of board games, because input randomness basically means that you have a randomized setup of some kind. So a lot of games use that with dice, where you roll the dice and now you get to make decisions with the dice as a resource. So like you can use a two over here and a six over here. So that's what we call input randomness, whereas output randomness is I make the decision and then I roll the dice to see how that decision goes. So one of them obviously gives you a lot more control.
Yeah. Output randomness is where basically you make the decision and then roll the dice to see whether you succeed or not, kind of.
Yeah, essentially, or to see how good it is, or to see whether it most of the time it's sort of like, does it work? Yeah. So a lot of combat systems that use dice is sort of like, I'm going to commit this much stuff and then I get to roll the dice. So you can have good output randomness because you have ways of manipulating the dice or moving things in your favor and things like that. But input randomness is quite a fun way of using dice because good games will do it that it's not just you want to roll high or you want to roll low, that there's uses for different dice.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, and backgammon is one of those, I think, yeah.
So I guess the question is, like you say, a board state in backgammon is maybe less transparent than one might be in 18xx. But I still think there are critical moments in an 18xx game where you can't entirely be sure whether or not you're ahead or behind.
Yes. Well, I think backgammon is less complex. Like it's easier to see the state of the game and make a determination from there. Plus, there's the randomness aspect of it. So there's a little bit of gambling. Like you could put an opponent in a position where they do need a specific dice roll in backgammon, right? So both players will then be able to see that, okay, one of them is in a worse position than the other. Whereas in 18xx, yeah, I don't know. I think it's a lot harder to see the complete state of the game because there's so much to it. And also there's not that like dice roll element. So there's not really a gambling element to 18xx, I don't think.
Well, the main interesting difference is that it's not 1v1, right? If you're talking about like a 4 or 5 player game and you introduce a doubling cube.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how that would work I suppose everyone would be beholden to it, but what if one person says, I'm out?
Yeah.
That wouldn't really work either, right? It would kind of break the game.
Yeah, Stephen raises that as well. He also says he's not sure how that will work in a multiplayer game. But yeah, it's something to think about. I think it's an interesting concept.
I like the idea of it. I think there's a few key moments, like after the private auction comes to mind, where someone could potentially place wagers. I guess it would not be sort of a doubling queue, but maybe you'd all place some kind of a wager.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've had the idea of playing 18xx for real money, right?
yes, exactly. Where you sort of ascribe some kind of value, and then the differences in values at the end would dictate how much percentage.
So the way that I see it working is, let's say we each put in $10 before we play the game, right? And then at the end of the game, you take every player's personal or player cash, add all of that together. So each player then has a percentage of the total money in the hands of the players.
Right. The net worth, yeah. I guess you would say. Every player's net worth. Yeah.
Let's say I have 10% of the total. I have $1,000 at the end of the game, and there's $10,000 combined player money. So I have 10%. So now I get 10% back of the total of the $10 that, let's say, four of us paid. So I get $4 back.
Yeah, I think that's the only way you could really make it work.
Yeah.
Because the bank often gets overdrawn and stuff like that. So it would really just be a percentage of the total net worth. It would fundamentally change the game in the sense that coming second would make a difference.
Yes.
You know, whereas normally it doesn't.
Yes.
So you may want to play more conservatively. You may want to be less risky. Going bankrupt is certainly worse. Yeah, so it's an interesting...
I think it would be interesting. I think it would be very thematic, actually, because like in real world investment, it's not about, you know, some one person walking away with all the money and everyone else going bankrupt. I think it could be, could make for an interesting 18xx play.
Yeah, we should try it sometime, actually, and see how it goes. It'd be interesting to think which game would be best for that. Like maybe a game that's less bankrupt heavy, maybe a game that's a little bit more run good company-ish kind of game.
We can try it with both.
Yeah, true. I suppose you're the one who goes bankrupt most often, so you're taking the biggest risk.
Yeah, but it shouldn't be for an amount of money that is like crazy. It should be a fun amount.
Yeah, like coming home, like telling your wife, like, yes, listen, honey, I lost the 18xx game. And, yeah. Anyway, long story short, I gave Fred keys to both our cars. he's coming to pick up a TV in the morning. Yeah, that wouldn't be great.
No, it should be a fun amount, an amount that no one minds losing.
But I like that idea. I like the idea of kind of wages. And I do think there's key moments. I think after the private auction would be one of the, if there were betting rounds in an 18xx, right, like there are in poker, that would be like the pre-flop almost, you know, like after the private auction, how you feel you are sort of geared up for the rest of the game.
Yeah.
I think that'd be a good sort of betting round. And then maybe, yeah, after sort of like the first or second stock round, you could have another one.
Well, there could be one after every stock round, I think.
Yeah, no, there could be for sure.
Yeah.
But I think there's definitely key moments in 18xx games.
Mm. Yeah.
And a lot of them would happen early on.
Yes.
I think that if you did have some kind of a doubling cube situation, you'd have to put a limit after it. So, like, you can't use it after, like, stock round four or something like that, you know? Or, like, once permanent trains come out, you can't use it anymore or something like that.
I don't know about that, because I mean it's almost like a different way of calling a game, right? At some point someone's going to say I double and everyone says no, and that's the same as calling the game.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I'm thinking of games as being foregone conclusions by that point, but I guess maybe that's kind of the point.
Yes, yeah.
That you just say to everyone, look, I've won.
Yeah.
He's not.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is essentially what it's an alternative to. Yeah, so that actually makes sense.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
I like it.
Yeah, cool. Interesting idea, Stephen. Thanks for your message and your support.
Yeah, I like we got a few messages and stuff regarding potential rules changes and things like that. So, yeah, we got some responses to our last episode as well. So I thought it'd be cool to discuss some of those.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, so... Where to start? Are we sort of deep in the emails now? Can I
go
all over the place?
Yes.
Okay, so let's see. So from our Patreon, Lachlan said that in his game that we chatted about in the podcast before, 18 Dracula, that sort of Halloween-themed 18XX that did quite a few things differently, but he said one of his, he sort of had monsters instead of trains, and the werewolves specifically, how they worked is that they would, if they hit a town or a city or whatever, they'd hit all the surrounding areas as well. Uh-huh. So everything that connects back to that area would pay out, which I thought that you could use in some kind of a train game as well, where you sort of create a network from one kind of a hub.
Right, yeah. So the hub, if you hit the hub, you hit all the surrounding connections as well. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, so I guess you could have trains that tie to specific home stations, maybe, like a train that ties, and then your goal would be to sort of connect as many places to that home station as possible.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, speaking of, can I jump in with a rule idea I had quickly? So while editing the podcast and listening to us talk about the rules, I had an idea for a different rule. So when you were talking about different train types specifically, so I thought, how about a cheap train that doesn't adjust your stock value when it runs? Like you can't run the train and pay out and move your stock up.
Wow.
Either that or that train can only withhold. So kind of similar. So let's say, so I have one original train and I have one of these cheap trains. So I'm running two routes, but I can then only pay out the one route that's not this cheap train.
Right. So the cheap train would potentially, it would have to be quite a long distance train, right, to make up for not moving your stock price.
Well, so these are basically two ideas. So either it doesn't move your stock price, but it pays normally. Or have a train that doesn't do that, can only withhold. It can only put money into the company. So, in other words, that also that train also wouldn't adjust your stock price by itself, but a different train might.
Right. So, if you had a normal train and this one that couldn't move the stock price, if you used both, you would have to pay out fully for both and not move your stock price. Right. Like whenever you use the non-stock moving train.
No, I think you would adjust your stock price according to the train that can pay out. So if that train runs for enough to move your stock price, you would adjust it according to that. But your other train would withhold.
Okay, so you'd have to have a separate rule in terms of moving your stock price only if you reach a specific value.
Right.
It wouldn't be like an 1830 or whatever where any value moves your stock price.
Exactly, yeah. You would have to pay out your current stock price value or something like that.
Okay. Okay. So the ultimate combo would be somehow setting up both.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Or, but you could get close to the end of the game where like someone's, all their trains rust and all they can afford is this cheap train that can't move your stock value.
Yeah. Yeah. That's cool.
And especially with maybe like a forced purchase, you have to buy the cheapest train in most cases, in most games, I think so.
Oh yeah. True. The cheapest one available from the bank usually.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, just an idea I had. I think it could be interesting.
Okay. Yeah, I think there's a few options for different trains, right? A lot of people messaged us to let us know that there were games that did have slightly more interesting train options. 1828, J.C. Lawrence's design was raised again. They said he has 3+D trains. So those are, the plus always includes towns and the D usually means double. So it'll double the amount. So for these ones, it'll be a 3-train that hits towns for free, any amount of towns for free, and doubles the value, but can only hit 3 real or sort of big value stops like cities or off boards.
Okay. Oh, interesting.
But interestingly, that train comes between the 5 and the 6 train.
Oh, okay. So it's a later game train.
Yeah. So it sort of is in between those two, which is quite cool. I always like it when you mix up the order. So it's not an alternative train, but it just comes in there between 2 other normal sort of linear progressions.
That is interesting, yeah.
And there's a few other games apparently that have double trains in between, which includes 18 Max actually, which is on our next to playlist.
Yeah,
we got a couple of emails as well. Okay, these were all related to withholding and paying out. So I want to go through each one. Did you have anything else in terms of trains specifically, in terms of different kinds of trains?
Me, no, just that.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, so we got a couple of emails on the sort of changing the way you can withhold or pay out.
Okay.
which is one of the other rules alternatives we kind of discussed. So Steve messaged us and he said, the main divergences for withholding paying out that came to mind for him are decoupling routes run from the amount paid out and decoupling stock changes from merely the decision to pay or withhold. So this sounds kind of similar to what you were saying, I think.
Did he give some examples of how decoupling the stock movement from the withhold decision works?
No, he didn't give an example of it. So it's essentially, I think, along the lines of what you're saying, where you can change how that works. So it's not always just that the route run is equal to the amount you pay out, and the stock change isn't always just did you pay or did you withhold.
Okay, yeah.
That you can, there's some design space within messing with those decisions specifically.
Right, yeah, interesting.
So he said, yeah, there are lots of ways that 18xx games fail as simulations of actually publicly traded companies. He said to him, the oddest one is when highly profitable companies are unable to pay their own train bills as they just keep paying out. And stock value often increases whether they pay $6 or $40 a share.
Mm.
I think 46 addresses both of these in interesting ways, and this should be done more. You could even allow for pay any amount up to the run plus stock bump if you pay at least the share price.
Mm, interesting. Yeah. Yeah. So the other way to do that would be just to say that all payouts have to happen from the company money. So the company treasury does the payout, which is effectively what happens if you run a route and do a full payout. Instead of taking the step of that money going into the company's treasury and then out to the shareholders, it just goes directly from the bank to the shareholders. But you could have that in between step where you run your routes, all that money comes to your company treasury, and now the company decides how much it wants to pay per share. And that money then comes from the treasury.
Yeah, I kind of like that idea, actually. That could be an interesting way of doing it, that every single thing is essentially, it starts as a withhold.
Yeah.
And then if you pay the share price equal to the share price in dividends, then you get to move up.
Right.
Yeah. But that's kind of your choice. And you can choose how much you'd like to pay.
Exactly. But with this way of doing it, you could theoretically pay more than your route ran for, because you might have withheld a previous time. So,
right, yeah.
If I withhold now and then in my next OR, I might even be able to pay double what my route ran for.
Right, that's true. That's true. You could do that. Or, yeah, I wonder if you could do that. It would create some interesting situations if you, I guess where it would be interesting is if you had a full cap kind of game, it might be a bit broken in terms of like, paying your, it would be much easier to extract money from your company in that case.
Well, in that case, it would be mean people would have to buy shares in each other much sooner, right? To prevent the president from just taking too much out.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
The other thing where I think it could be interesting is if you had stock price movements based on the amount you pay. Like if you pay double your stock price value, you do double jumps and stuff. That might be a good way, like, good way to do double jumps is just withhold. Even though your route isn't that great, you would be able to pay double by just by withholding once or twice.
Correct. Yeah, I think there's some interesting design space there. I mean, obviously you're adding complexity, but that actually does sound quite interesting to fiddle with some of those things that we take for granted.
Yeah, yeah.
Carl from our Patreon actually raised a good point. A simple point, really, just that if you have too many different payout options, it drastically slows down the game.
Absolutely.
Which yeah. I think is kind of a fair point.
Yeah.
Once you get too complex, you're opening up the game for a lot of mathing, a lot of sort of mathing out how much do I want to pay. And if someone's doing that every single time they run a route, that could get quite intense. So I think for a lot of this, there's a lot of playtesting that would kind of need to happen in this, I feel like, in terms of how does this work out in practice? Mm. Does it become too much maths? Do we make the map simpler? Do we make the payouts bigger? You know, you might have to change quite a lot of how the game sort of works in order to accommodate some of these changes.
Yes.
Simplify some other aspects of the game and then put that complexity back into the other side.
Right, yeah. Yeah, no, that is a very valid point. Like every decision takes time, and the more decision options you add, the longer it takes. So yeah, no, that's definitely a good point.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, and then we got a message from Tom as well. And he said he's just on a run listening to our latest episode, and he had to stop and send this email while it occurs to him.
Oh, cool.
thanks for disrupting your workout for us. Yeah. So he said, what if the third option was to ransack the company, steal all the payout for the other shareholders, then in the next stock or merger acquisition round, face a vote from the other shareholders to be removed as director with your shares going into the market or bought up by the other shareholders? Just a thought.
Interesting.
I love where people are going with this stuff. Like, I have no idea if any of this will work. No. But whenever I read this, I'm like, oh, man, that sounds exciting. I don't know if it's the filthy, like, Ameritrash player that's, like, deep inside me that wants to, like, have this raucous stock round where people are, like, voting me out and I'm stating my case, you know? But it just sounds awesome. I kind of love it, you know? I love that aspect of kind of screwing people over, but then facing repercussions.
Well, that's interesting. So that kind of reminds me of merger voting, right? Where if I have 30% and someone else is 30%, the two of us combined could vote for a merger because we have more than 50% combined. So this could be something like, let's say you're president of a company and you have 40% and two other people have 30%. They could vote you out as president because combined they have more than 50%.
Yeah, exactly. There could be some kind of threshold or something like that.
Mm.
I'm not sure, but I like the idea. I like the idea of having an option that is almost like a, not a panic button, but sort of a big move. So this isn't something that you're going to do multiple times a game. This is something that you might do once or twice, and you might pick your moment when you do it and sort of make a big play, get a ton of money. But then there's some sort of consequence, some kind of repercussion for that. And you have to balance those things out. So maybe it's a short-term benefit with a long-term risk attached to it.
Right.
And so now you're under pressure to use that money in a sort of a useful way to propel yourself into some kind of a lead, because on the back end of this is a consequence that you're not going to like.
Yeah.
So whether or not it's this specifically, I like the spirit of it quite a lot.
Yes.
And I think there's interesting stuff to be done there. I love the idea of having something drastic or something very big that you can potentially do that, yeah, like I say, comes with a a consequence.
Right, yeah.
And it adds a little bit of tension because everyone knows this risk is there. And I think there's a timing element to it. If it's something that you can only reasonably do once or twice a game, or something that you can only do with one company, with a company once, let's say, you're only reasonably able to pull it off once with each company you have, then it becomes a timing thing for shareholders, not that dissimilar from people dumping a company on you when you have to know when to get out, potentially.
One way to kind of restrict it from being used too often is that you can only do something like that if the president decides to withhold or after the president decides to withhold. Because if you think about it, if the president is paying dividends, the shareholders theoretically should be happy, right?
Yeah.
So maybe only allowed to do it if a president withholds money at the end of that OR. So let's say the company's in trouble, the president has to withhold in order to buy a train in a forced purchase. But now at the end of this OR, they're going to lose the company anyway.
Yeah, so I mean, for me, it's not that dissimilar from dumping a company on someone else. You know, it's actually less risk if you think about it, than losing out on a payout is often way less damaging than having someone dump a company on you. So I think it's definitely an acceptable risk for a shareholder. I think it just creates, again, that thing, you know, with dumping a company, it becomes a metagame thing where you know when a company's garbage. You know, people aren't going to let you dump a piece of trash company on them because they would have gotten out by then. They wouldn't put themselves in that position for the most part.
Right.
So it becomes this tension of, do I dump this early, even though it's still got some money, you know, and there's this sort of back and forth of how greedy do you want to be? How greedy do you want to stay invested? Do you want to dump the company early to potentially get into something else, even though you're giving that person not too terrible of a company, but it's going to become a liability later? I see this as kind of the same kind of thing where if you're going to face a consequence, it's sort of like, do I do this ransack option now, even though I could still get more value out of this, but they're going to see it coming if I wait another stock round to do it. So I have to do it now if I'm going to do it. You know, and there's this kind of back and forth tension to it that I think is always interesting.
Yeah.
So I like the idea of it as something, an extra lever to pull that isn't going to come up every single OR or anything like that, or drastically change how you play the game. But it's just, it's there as this option, and it creates some fun moments. It creates some extra tension. Yeah,
yeah.
I like it. I like the spirit of it, certainly. I mean, I'm not a game designer. I have no idea how any of the stuff would play out in practice. But I think people are coming up with some great ideas in terms of ways to look at things differently or things to consider.
Yes.
Yeah. I hope someone clever and smart and good at designing games comes up with something cool. That'd actually be really cool. Because I actually think the more we chat about this and the more people send us stuff, I feel like there's some interesting design space here.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Yeah, it would be interesting to see some of them. And I think some of them we could even just try ourselves. Just take an existing 18xx and make some of these changes to see how it works.
Yeah, for sure. I think that if we, if we both were in retirement and we could just spend all day playing 18xx games, I bet we'd do all kinds of crap like that.
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
Like, let's try this today. Well, if we are on episode 2037 and after our round of bingo at the retirement village, we can give it a go.
Backgammon.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, cool.
All right. So then I actually got a message on Twitter from Brennan. He just pointed out that 1871 has explicit negotiation rules which are binding.
Oh, interesting.
So I don't know a lot more about it. I sent him a tweet back. I only saw it today because I'm terrible with Twitter. But I just said to him, has he played it and what was his kind of experience of it? So, if he messages back, I will update us on how exactly that works. He said something interesting. He said something to do with like sort of the owned track portion of the game. And I realized I didn't know what the owned track portion of the game was. So, yeah, I'm curious to look into it a little bit more. But yeah, apparently that's, and I think someone mentioned 18 Island also has some rules around negotiation, but 1871 seems to have it as a core part of the game.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah, there's been a lot of chats actually in our Patreon Discord about all different kinds of rules and rules changes and house rules that people have come up with and people speaking out in defense of Lola.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I don't know if you saw, but Per mentioned that there's a game group in Sweden that plays with the turn order pass type rule.
Oh, yes. And they've implemented for lots of games. Yes. They just sort of almost replace Lola with it.
They do, yeah, yeah. Yeah, which sounds cool. So if people are doing it, there must be something to it. It must work well.
Yeah, man, I trust those Swedes. They know what's up.
I'm keen to give it a try, that rule.
Yeah, I think we should as well. It's very easy to implement. So
yeah,
I think it will be an interesting thing just to put a little spin on something.
For sure, yeah.
Oh, and the last thing I wanted to ask you was, there was a little bit of a discussion in our Patreon as well around towns and how they're handled in games. So what I specifically mean is in terms of the restriction of towns. So some games will have trains that always just skip towns. So you count them as revenue, but you don't have to use them as a stop. Some games will have them upgrade into green tiles, which have a little bit more routes. And some games, like 1889, towns become a serious restriction where they count as a revenue thing and you can't upgrade them to green. So they always go in the direction that you've originally placed them. So I was curious what you yourself kind of like best when it comes to handling towns.
I think that depends on a lot on the map. Like, some maps, the towns don't really get in the way. On some maps, I think it's an interesting decision because it allows you to run an early route. Like there's a town close to your home station, so you can quickly build to there and start running routes as soon as possible. But later in the game, they kind of become in the way because now your long route has to go through there and count it as a stop. So now you decide, do you like reroute around it by taking the time to lay new track or things. So I think it depends a lot on the map. So just my personal preference, I think I kind of like towns just because it's usually they are the early routes you can run. But maybe later game, it's nice to have like an express type train that doesn't count them as a stop. So you kind of have that train option later to kind of skip over them almost.
Yeah, I think when I'm playing a game, I always feel relieved to see those plus trains that you just get to breeze past them. I think in terms of design space, they're probably more interesting as restrictive, where you can sort of, like you say, they have this advantage early of being a route that you can run to. It lets you set up multiple two trains and things like that, and it often feels nice. But later on, they become such a hindrance because they're counting against your four trains and your five trains, and they're so irritating and you can't get around them and you have to build around them and all that stuff. But I think that actually is probably a more interesting design space than just having them there as free revenue centers.
Mm.
So as much as I like it when you can mess with them or when you can just ignore them, I think that in general, but I think my gaming tastes in particular, I like feeling restricted. I like the puzzle of being restricted in some way. Even in the Euro games we play, I always like them when they're very tight, when resources are scarce, when you have to really kind of manage everything and it doesn't come easily, rather than those huge sandbox games where you just get to do whatever you want.
Right, yes.
I tend to like that sort of tight rule set where resources and stuff feel scarce. So I think that's probably why I like them, because I feel like they create interesting decisions instead of just being this thing on the board that exists and makes your life a bit easier. I think that, yeah, going to a town or building out from a town actually becomes an interesting decision in something like 1889.
Right, yeah.
That's just me personally, though. I think there isn't a right or wrong answer. But I do think towns are quite an interesting design space that's often neglected or not spoken about that much in the context of 18XX. They just sort of are there. But I think they can have a pretty huge impact on how games play out.
Yes. No, I agree. But I do think it comes down to the map design a lot.
Yeah, I just think if you're a new player coming into any new 18XX, you should find out, are there towns? Can I upgrade them?
Right.
I think those are questions you should ask yourself, and do the trains skip them?
Nice.
I think figure that out early, or else you might be like Simon playing 1889 and just be enraged that he can't change the direction of his town and swore to never play an 18XX with towns ever again.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, I think, so if I had to choose between upgradable towns or trains that skip them, I think I prefer trains that skip them.
They do feel so comfortable.
Yeah, and it also, not being able to upgrade the town is a restriction, like you say. It's a good restriction. You can't reroute easily or change your, yeah, yeah.
It's quite a big commitment what tile you use for towns and things like that as well.
Yeah. Yeah, either one works, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone's different. Like, I hate 00 tiles. I just can't stand them. But some people really like them.
Yeah.
And I would purge them from every game in existence if I could. I hate them. So, yeah, I don't think there's a right or wrong. Oh, I hate them. I'm actually getting, like, flashbacks, PTSD style, thinking about them. I get so upset. Okay, never mind. Moving on. But when we say towns, we mean dits, doinks, whatever you guys call them.
Towns.
The little black squares. Yeah, we call them towns.
I call them towns, yeah.
I think the old people call them dits.
Yes.
The veterans.
I've heard dits. Some people call them dits, yeah.
Yeah, sometimes doinks. Doinks, but that's like a little too 90s for my life.
It sounds like a pet name for dits.
Yeah, exactly. Those are the people who like towns.
Yeah, an affectionate name.
Yeah, exactly. All right, sweet. Okay. Last thing, I had a genius or grifter for you.
Oh, cool.
It's kind of a multi-layered one, though. It's just something I was thinking about. So I'm going to give you the scenario, but then I think there's a little bit more of a philosophical question attached to it.
Okay.
So what I said was, how do you feel about exploiting new players in imbalanced, in inverted commas, situations? For example, playing a game of 1830, you place a cheap bid on the CNA and start the waterfall early to make sure that you get it for cheap, with those players not knowing that you're getting it for $10 over the price, and then immediately floating the pen or whatever has essentially won you the game.
Right. That is an interesting one. In general, I don't like taking advantage of people in a game just because I know something they don't, especially if I'm teaching the game. Okay, so I think it's different whether I'm teaching the game or not. So if I'm teaching a game, I might tell someone, look, you guys are making or are allowing me to get this for very cheap, so maybe you should start bidding on this. Like, I think as part of my teach of the game, I would point stuff like that out. On the other hand, though, doing stuff like warning someone when a company might get dumped on them, I've done that in the past. and then the play turned out not to be so interesting. I think there it depends on the player. I think some people would like to see total destruction in, you know, getting a company dumped on them and then going bankrupt. Like, I don't think I've seen a case where that turns someone away from playing an 18xx again. So it is very, very tricky. I think for something very early on, like a private auction, I might point it out and just say, like, this is a very valuable company. You can't let it go for too cheap. Maybe not put a price on it or anything like that, but just say, be aware, don't let this go for too cheap. Whereas later in a game, after 3 hours, someone goes bankrupt, I think that's maybe fine and a better case than almost losing a game in the private auction.
Yeah, so the sort of sub question I had for this is basically, if one player has knowledge of a game, are they obligated to share it with others? If they are experienced with a particular game and the other people are new to that game. So let's say they've all played 18xx before, but they've never played 1830. They don't know anything about 1830. And I, as a player, know that. And now I plan to exploit that.
I think it's, again, where are you teaching the game or aren't you? If you're teaching these people how to play 18xx, I think you should point stuff like that out. If they are experienced 18xx players and all you're doing is playing this 18xx with them that they haven't played before, I think there's not really an obligation there to point stuff like that out.
You see, it's interesting. So, I mean, let's say they've experienced 18xx players, but somehow they've never come across 1830. They just haven't. Okay, just pretend. This is very unlikely, right? But I'm using 1830 because it's an easy example, and it has a particularly imbalanced need-to-know kind of thing when it comes to the private auction. So that is the question, right? They've played 18xx before. They're familiar with it. And I say, this is 1830, standard, full cap. Let's go. 60% to float. Waterfall auction. Here we go. I bid 165 on the CNA.
Yeah.
You know? Is it up to them in that moment to correctly evaluate it and read it and be like, wow, that seems really good? I think you could perhaps have that expectation of people who had played 18xx before. But essentially, in any case, even a case more complex than this, maybe where you have a lot of experience with the game and you know a trick or you know something about that game, right, that can give you a huge advantage and that other people maybe even are less likely to know, or they need to have kind of played it to know. Is it genius or grifter to exploit that easily? That you can easily exploit that. You know, you come into the game thinking, I'm just going to exploit this and probably crush these people with my better knowledge of this game.
Yeah, I don't think there's a...
Are those just the breaks, as they say?
I don't think I can give you a Boolean answer there. I think if I'm teaching the game, I would feel like a grifter if I did that. But if I'm not teaching the game or I'm playing with experienced players, well, yeah, again, if it's something early on like a private auction, I probably would point it out. If I'm going to dump a company on someone that's experienced, I won't point it out. And then there's this gray area in between.
Yeah, I think I probably verge on grifter for this one. I think that I would probably say in the teach, especially with experienced players. And again, like, even if I'm not really teaching it, if I'm like, this is 1830, and they're like, oh yeah, 1830, okay, it's normal, right? It's all basic rules, yeah. And they say, like, anything we should know or any, like, you know, weird divergences. And I just say, no, it's full cap, 60%.
If they ask, then definitely.
Right. But maybe they're not asking about that. Maybe they're just asking, you know, what are the MacGuffins, yes, right? What are the differences?
Yeah.
I will say, you know, just so you know, this private is much better than the other ones.
Right.
Or just so you know, this track over here can only be upgraded in this way.
Yeah.
You know, something like that. Something where it's kind of a gotcha moment after it happens.
Yeah.
And they'll be like, oh, we didn't know that you couldn't upgrade this one to green. Like, right. Yeah, you can't. There's actually no tile that fits that one.
Yeah,
I knew that.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like I'd want to kind of level the playing field in that sense. Like, hey, you should probably know that this particular thing is this and that. I tend to do that. I think it does get tricky when it comes to how much help you give people. Like, Do you say to them, oh, just be aware, someone's about to dump a company on you? Because that interferes with everyone's gameplay as well. Right. So what I generally do with that is I say, be careful when you invest 20%. You are vulnerable. It means that this can happen. I'll tell people that when I teach them 18xx for the first time.
Right.
And then when it happens, it's like, yep, told you.
Yeah.
And I'll do it to them as well, you know.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I think we're pretty much on the same page. Like, even if you're teaching experienced players an 18xx they haven't played, I think part of your teaching responsibility is probably just pointing out those gotchas. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's what I'd call them. I'd call them almost the gotchas. Mm. Like, I wouldn't explain every little detail of the game. And if I'm just more experienced and I win because of that, that's fine. Hopefully they're there to have fun playing the game and learning it. They're not too worried about winning anyway.
Right.
No, I'm certainly not. But yeah, if they are just little gotchas, like, just so you know, this tile can never be upgraded and it's a critical thing. Or, you know, just so you know, this private company stands out way ahead of all the others. So I don't know, simple things like that, I will probably just tell them.
Yes.
If it's something that I think of that I feel like they need to know, I'll just be like, oh yeah, just a heads up.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's probably, because otherwise it feels a little griftery to me.
Yes, yeah, I agree.
So I don't think I'd feel too bad if someone did it to me.
No, probably not. But like, I also tell people very often, if I'm teaching a game, like, consider your first play just a learning experience. Like, consider your first play learning the game. And I approach games that way as well. So if someone did it to me, I would just consider that part of my learning the game, I think.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question that if one player has some kind of superior knowledge, are they obligated to share it with others? I think that's the sort of base question underneath all of this. And yeah, I'm not sure. I kind of want to say yes to a point. Yes, for explicitly sort of opaque or imbalanced in some way things, I think I would.
Yeah, and I feel especially for something that happens early in the game, like the private auction, because someone, because of the opaqueness, someone could lose the game there without even knowing it.
Yeah.
Whereas if they lose the game late in the game, I think that's fine. They've learned a lot up to that point.
Yeah, exactly. I agree with that.
Cool. Interesting one.
Yeah. Last up, South African fact.
Okay.
So did you know, Fred, you did know this, but did the rest of you know, South Africa has quite an interesting history when it comes to fossils. So just nearby, Fred and I, about 40 minutes from us or so, 30 minutes, is the cradle of humankind, where they found the oldest known modern humans.
Right.
So that's kind of where we considered that, sort of like modern humans began, was just outside of Joburg, or at least that's where we found it.
That is a bit of a coincidence, actually.
Yeah.
I wonder, maybe they were after the gold as well. Who knows?
Yeah, but also back in 2013, we actually found Homo naledi as well, which was kind of a big deal in the archaeological world, which is sort of, I guess you could call it kind of like a missing link. It was sort of another
of the transitional fossils. Yeah.
Yes, one of the transitional fossils to kind of modern humans. And that was found quite recently, also in the cradle of humankind.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I think the generally accepted theory is that modern humans started somewhere in Africa and spread out from there. It doesn't mean that cradle of humankind is the starting point. It's just the most viable starting point we found so far.
Yeah, it's just where we found the oldest ones to date.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also, I read that 80% of mammalian fossils have all been found in the Karoo, which is an area in South Africa as well.
80% of all mammalian fossils. Wow.
Yeah.
That's massive.
So we quite fossil heavy, because you think Africa in general, right? Like the whole like Pangaea vibe, you know, it kind of has an African flavor to it. But then for all of it to be in South Africa is quite interesting, actually. Mm. I suppose it's got a good climate. It's coastal.
Yeah.
Lots of rivers. I don't know. I guess it kind of works out. You know, it's funny. I was talking to my friend. We had a bra over the weekend or a bad queue.
You're not allowed to call it that as a Southern.
Yeah. So we had one of those. And she was telling me that she actually found this really important human fossil when she was like 10.
Really?
It was this major like ocular. Yeah, she was like in the paper and stuff. And it led to finding a bunch of others. And I think it was part of this whole cradle of humankind thing, like oldest known fossils or whatever. But she told me quite resentfully that she got none of the credits.
Oh, no. Why not?
Basically, like, some archaeologist was sort of leading this expedition or whatever. And I think her dad was like a geologist or something like that. And he was there to help or whatever. And she found this leg bone or something. And then they all dug around there and they found all this other important stuff. And then, yeah, the archaeologist got all the credits. Oh, man. She's like, I found it.
Wow.
10-year-old me. Yeah, but it was apparently quite a big deal. It was quite like a major discovery.
Well, that's a very cool story. But if she doesn't get the credit, they should give her the bone back at least.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Wow. Yeah, that's a very cool story. It's amazing how someone can accidentally kind of discover something like that.
Yeah, so she's up there with the great snubbed intellectuals, like yes. People who really discovered the structure of DNA and, you know.
Intellectual. Well, I mean, she was digging in the dirt, was no offense to your friend.
She's probably trying to make like a sandcastle in the dirt. No, she was totally there with like a little brush and a little hammer and stuff, you know?
Oh, that's awesome. Wow.
Yeah, that's how she will tell it anyway.
Very cool.
Yeah, man. So that's it. So Africa, fossils,
yeah.
Gold, diamonds, platinum.
No coal. Oil. Not a lot of oil.
No oil. Yeah. We're all about the precious metals. That's how we roll.
And stones, yeah.
Yeah, and coal. I think we've got a crap load of coal.
Yes. Yeah, we do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And bras.
And bras. That's what we use the coal for.
Exactly. Oh, everyone's welcome to a bra at my house. Once lockdown's over, come and visit.
Sweet.
I have a spare room. You can stare at my board game collection while you sleep. It's in there.
Nice.
Yeah. Sweet, everyone. Well, thank you so much for listening. We managed to fill our time pretty well, I think.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks for all the emails, everyone. Tweets, emails, etc. I think it gave us some interesting stuff to chat about. So, yeah, I've really enjoyed these casts on kind of the rules and mixing it up. And yeah, I think some interesting ideas actually came out of it. So, yeah, thanks a lot, everyone.
Yeah, for sure. Cool. Thanks very much.
Cheers.
Bye. If you would like to get in touch with us, we are at derailed18xx on Instagram and Twitter. You can email us, derailed18xx@gmail.com. And we're on Patreon at patreon.com/derailed18xx. Thanks for listening.